We are now recording. Welcome to the PeopleStock podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and architect of the PeopleStock. My guest for this episode is Eugene Geis. He is director of data science at Deluxe Marketing Solutions. Welcome, Eugene.
Hi, Jen.
It's great to have you here today. And so let's get started straight away and learn a little bit about what you do. So what does it mean to you to be a director of data science? And I'm also curious what the favorite part of your job is.
Okay. So to be a director of data science in terms of how, what does it mean? That's an interesting question. And I think I have to pull back and be a little bit objective to think about what it means. I came to Florida for the job after coming out of academia and doing a whole second stint in grad school. So when I think objectively just about that title, it sort of feels that it means that I have to have a reputation of credibility to maintain pretty much at all times, no matter who I'm talking to. They come to me with questions, and I have to give them answers, and they have to truly believe in those answers and walk away and then use that for whatever realm of the job that they need to do based on the intelligence or insight or quantitative metrics that I can provide for them. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. What about on a day-to-day basis? I know there's usually no such thing as a typical work day, but what are the kinds of things, kinds of tasks and activities you might find yourself working on any given day?
So a lot of what we do at Deluxe Marketing is around performance of marketing, especially of financial campaigns. And so targeted marketing for acquiring checking customers to your bank versus targeting customers to whom are highly likely to get a mortgage loan. If one of these campaigns goes awry and the client makes a phone call to a salesperson, this isn't going the way that I expected it to, my ROI is too low, my cost per acquisition is too high, then it comes to us. And then we have to dive really deep into, you know, were we targeting the right people? Were we not, sort of providing the lift that the customer expected when they started this contract with us? And so to troubleshoot it and then get the next iteration going, hopefully the client still wants to be a part of the relationship and engage in the relationship and to believe in our ability to do it. Mm-hmm. A lot of it, you know, on the day-to-day activities, when I think about something lands on my desk and we got to figure out how to keep the client here, it's an all-go, you know, mission, almost militarized, right? We got to go back and get this territory. We can't lose our advantage. So that's actually what, you know, brings me to part of what you asked is also my favorite part of the job. And I think that it's solving these unique problems is sort of, you know, motivational in and of itself, because each one is different and you learn about so many different aspects of your clients and their approach to people. So there is a lot of, I would say, just ad hoc and analysis. We don't know what to make of these numbers. Can you go find out? We don't know what to make of our customers as they are today. Can you go figure out what the patterns are? What's different about us and our group? Who have they gotten loans from before? And who, when they left us and go had their loans refi, who did they go to instead? Mm-hmm. And those kinds of things. We have to dive under the covers, grab the data, find these people in the last year to 2 years of data, and, you know, give them that information back.
Got it. So the clients would be, for example, credit card companies?
The clients are sometimes credit card companies. The majority of the time they are bigger loan type companies or big financial institutions like, you know, if you've seen JP Morgan Chase Bank sort of around and they're just trying to get customers in their local area. They're not one of our clients, but using them as an example, because I can, you know, that they're just they're trying to reach out to the neighborhood and run a campaign that will bring Lyft and actually acquire customers. Otherwise, why have a branch? Mm. You know, so let's say a new one opens up. We got to figure out who are the most likely neighborhoods for them to grab from. Mm. And part of what we do even goes into compliance because it's so financially driven. There's new laws that sort of state that if you have a local bank that is situated in a census tract area, that your portfolio of accounts need to be representative of the demographics of the people that are nearby the bank. So mm-hmm. some people are coming to us, not even for necessarily targeted marketing in a way that will provide them more customers, but in a way to actually adjust the demographics of their portfolios so that mm-hmm. it is equitable to the local region.
Got it. And that gets a little bit into something else I wanted to ask Eugene. For the hardcore data geeks out there, or the folks like me who were once hardcore data geeks and have been out of it for a little bit, I am curious you don't have to talk about it at a specific level of detail, and you probably can't in terms of, you know, client confidentiality and stuff like that. But just in terms of general kinds of analyses, you know, are we talking just kind of basic percentages comparing averages, or do you get really fancy and go into stuff like modeling and things like that?
We absolutely get fancy, but we try and be as close to the averages and medians as possible when discussing the fanciness, because you never know when you're on the other line, you know, the other end of the phone call with a CMO, and the CMO does not have the quantitative chops that, let's say, the marketing director has. And mm-hmm. you got to hit both of these people with the conversation, and they both have mm-hmm. to understand it. And the visuals and the visualization of the data is so important to tell the story mm-hmm. and to have somebody who sort of can bring the information down to that level where you're not geeking out about the data, because I taught high school for a little while, even after getting a PhD in physics. And to teach high school, you got to talk, you know, back about when I hit the ball goes in this shape. And yeah, let's not talk about the air resistance, because yes, you stick your hand out the window and the air pushes your arm back. But guess what? Everything mm-hmm. we're going to talk about in this class has nothing to do with how the air pushes on the ball. Mm-hmm. Everything gets really complicated when you talk about how the air pushes on the ball. but in terms of the statistics that we throw out, I would say that the deepest I have to go on phone calls is to sort of say why. Or how a multivariate model works to increase someone's score or likelihood. And I make constant analogies to, you know, what if I wanted to rank all the best pitchers in the Major League Baseball, you know, in the American League versus the National League? What if I wanted to draft the most likely running back that will be successful in the NFL? What would be my metrics for that? And, you know, I can't just use one. I got to use like five, right? And you want all five to work together to make your score. These are the kinds of stories that you have to bring down to that level. So I would love to geek out, and I love throwing out the idea of, multicollinearity, or these terms that are really eclectic to the data science geeks, but it makes it very difficult to do that on a normal client call. Even with my own sales group, there's, you know, a level that I have to adhere to saying, this is pedantic, don't do it.
Yeah, you certainly want to make sure everyone's on the same page and everyone's understanding so you can all march toward that same goal. I think just on this topic a little bit more, and then we can move on. I think one of the things that I always struggled with in explaining to people, and that I hear, like when I hear news reports about it, I'm always like, I really wish they would have gone into that a little bit more, is the concept of controlling for a variable or variables. And that's, you know, extremely important, and it can really kind of differentiate the really good research from the terrible research when you're not controlling for certain factors. So is that something, you know, the idea of controlling for variables statistically, is that something that you talk about and come up with analogies to explain to your clients or partners?
Yes, and this is a fascinatingly nuanced topic, because in the as I've gone into the hardcore statistics realm of quantitative metrics, while in an education department doing it, one of the things that is always talked about is that control for bias. Mm-hmm. And bias is sort of, I guess, how the statisticians use the term. We call it, you know, confounding variables, or this controlling for, you know, the local area, the economics of the neighborhood. The bias of the data set is very difficult to discuss with clients, especially when we create a series of generic scores at work. Mm. And the generic scores at work are always the targeted population versus randoms. And when the client comes to us and says, listen, we already have criteria, and our criteria includes a FICO range of 550 to 650 and a utilization of credit card debt from 20% up to 120%. And this is what's going to pass underwriting. As soon as you throw in that underwriting criteria and or marketing criteria, that is the bias of the universe. And the things that I have to describe, and I usually use the sports analogies because they seem to be the most ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to model a score for the best major league pitchers, but all you used are the data from your local regional high schools and their competitions, and you perfectly rank order those pitchers in your local vicinity, what is your model going to do when they see a 98 mile an hour fastball? Because I'm sure it's never seen that in the regional high schools that are competing, you know, if you're actually taking that kind of data. So, you know, that level of a biased data set is very difficult to get across. My wife keeps, correcting me. I say across a lot, like as if as an ED. You make any faux pas like this and your normal English language?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Yeah, you know, you have two PhDs, but you can't get across right. Yes. No, I love the sports analogies. I think are generally well taken. You know, even if somebody, you know, doesn't really even follow sports, you can at least connect to that idea of, oh wow, yeah, you can't really, that's definitely going to introduce some bias into the data set. And so, you know, when it gets to that point, then How would you explain, like, the actual controlling? How would you say, okay, there's this confounding variable here, which can be like, you know, how fast the ball is going? Do you get into details about what gets done to the data set? Sometimes what I used to do is it's basically just, we do some magic to the data set so that, you know, on a conceptual level, this happens. But then sometimes people would jump in and say, well, how do you do that exactly? And then you got to kind of gauge your audience, right? Like, how much are you going to really understand about what I'm about to say? Or are you just trying to show off or something like that?
Exactly.
So how do you approach that?
So the easiest way for me to describe it, and again, I use the analogies, but try and stick close to what they're doing. I say, listen, if you guys are marketing in New York and all you gave me were responders that came from Alabama, and I try and build my model to target those people that you gave me, my score is going to favor people that resemble the patterns of behavior, demographics, financial data, whatever it is, of those people in Alabama. And they're not going to look like the people in New York, because now that you're expanding into these other states, I don't think the model's going to perform as well. We can test with it if you'd like, but I would go a little deeper so that you are not biasing everything to the best of the best of the best of what people look like in Alabama, because there may be pockets where there are different variables that have a relationship that provides lift in New York, the state of New York, the state of Massachusetts, places in the Northeast that we know you know, carte blanche. They are very, very different types of people than the people that are in the Southeast.
And it's always the variability in human behavior and human tendencies that kind of makes everything so nuanced and interesting in my estimation. But yeah, so let's get out of the weeds for a little bit, take a couple of steps back, and I'd like to talk about the way that you see it. What are some ways that we could impactfully apply psychometrics in talking about and in solving some of the tech/people problems that exist?
I love this question. Now, are you interested in, just in case the average listener hasn't heard the word psychometrics before, what you may be implying by asking that question? Because I think for some people, they say, what the heck is psychometrics?
Very good. Very, very good thing to point out there. Yeah, what I really mean is a combination of things. Data science, statistics, you know, getting into the weeds like what we were talking about before in terms of the actual analyses. How can we take all of these numbers in front of us, all of these ones and zeros or ones and twos and threes and onwards, and make sense of them and find patterns and actually use them to make decisions? But also, I guess I mean it more of a conceptual level as well. Some of the concepts and the theories and the principles around even just research methods, right? Those principles can be used to think about tech and people problems. So that's a great question, and that's basically what I mean by it.
Yeah, and I think people problems is, you know, the vaulting point for where psychometrics even tried to step off the ledge, so to say. And I always try and say, hey guys, have you heard of, you know, econometrics? Well, psychometrics is more with a psychological bent. And the psychological bent in terms of how I see psychometrics, the first way, right, is that almost every company at the start of an interview process does some level of a personality test. Almost every company nowadays does this or offers you something that is akin to an IQ test, even though you're not allowed to say that. It can't be an IQ test, but it can be a whole series of tests that sort of correlate with the overall latent variable people know as an IQ, which also I'm using the words latent variable, which is not necessarily user-friendly either. The way that I like to talk about latent variables is that your SAT score is trying to measure something like intelligence, and there is no number that assesses intelligence, just like your FICO score tries to assess your riskiness, and there is no number for riskiness. And I think the thing that immediately made me a viable candidate to work in the financial targeted marketing world is my actual contextual understanding and nuts and bolts understanding of how they fit an SAT score. Because a wrong question on a test is the same thing as missing a payment on a loan. And that's a fascinating analogy the first time people hear that. They're like, wait a second, so my FICO score is a model? And I'm like, yeah. Your FICO score is 100% a little bit of a, I would say it's a psychometric model more than just a pure econometric model, because it is based in human behavior, and it's literally the bank's trustworthiness in you as a person to make your payment, which is the same as getting your answer correct on your SATs. So I love the connection. And the other thing is, I had a member of my team that worked in, that was finishing his PhD in psychometrics. And the what I loved about his ability to solve data science / statistical problems is that by being in psychometrics, he was learning statistics through the mechanism of trying to apply it. And I think that is so key to anyone out there that does anything quantitative. If you're not applying the mathematical methods you're using, you're always missing some level of the context or some level of the creativity by which you can apply the mathematics to fulfill your role or to use your skill set in its most optimal way. Mm-hmm. You have to be very creative, and especially in statistics, because all the data is just a you know, I would call it a shotgun effect of a blur of that data point's over there, but that one's over there. And you know what? I'm just going to call that one an outlier and get rid of it, which is probably the most the most disingenuous thing to ever do with data. But so psychometrics, I think, and the last point I want to make about this too, it's very interesting that as I see the C-level groups sort of go on their offsites and their retreats, they do a whole lot of psychometric test taking, and this is my personality, so this will make me more effective as a leader, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And this makes me think, and tell me if this resonates with you. I just hung out with two of my friends that are in sort of their second or third level of funding for a startup. And one of the things I said is that, and I just threw out this observation at them, said it seems that EQ is so much more important here than IQ, as I walked around and met all of these people that were talking about their startups and doing all of these fun projects to try and get to their next level of funding or to network and make more connections to other VCs that could fund them for something else. Mm-hmm. This EQ versus IQ, when you get past a certain level, may also resonate with the idea that people said, it's funny, it's the C students that end up managing the A students.
that absolutely does resonate with me. With the caveat that both of them are very hard to measure, and particularly I think maybe even EQ a bit more when you take a look at the research on, for example, what are some of the best predictors of job performance. Again, it's not necessarily called IQ, usually more like cognitive ability. The cognitive ability tests tend to be better predictors of job performance in certain kinds of jobs with certain kinds of people versus emotional intelligence or emotional stability or however you would want to phrase that. But I think definitely, to your point, Eugene, as we get higher and higher up in the leadership levels, there's a ceiling effect going on there where it's like, okay, everyone's smart. That's how you got there. You couldn't have gotten there without that. So then what are the differentiators that are happening that kind of differentiate, for example, the excellent leaders from, let's say, the exceptional or extraordinary leaders, and that's when we can start, you know, talking about emotional intelligence and stuff like that. So yeah, that's a great example. So you see, for example, personality testing or testing for, say, emotional stability or emotional intelligence is really in terms of getting back to the question, that can be a way where we can really apply psychometrics to really kind of solving these people problems at work.
Yeah, it's a fascinating sort of, as soon as you go into the EQ, and I like to, every once in a while reference the guy from Harvard, Daniel Goleman. Mm-hmm. I think he took a whole bunch of people's research and basically repackaged it in a nice, you know, set of language and sort of popularized it. But the social intelligence is a whole nother level of, you know, if you want to go with the SQ, what is your SQ? Mm-hmm. And I like how that piggybacks on emotional intelligence. And I can say definitely in my own experience, I've had to really focus on those elements of my personality for a short time period. And literally after I was like 28, there's just some people that are so naturally good at this level of social parlance and body language, and they don't even know what it is that they're doing. They're just great at it. But it also, because they don't know what they're doing with it, they can't necessarily teach it. You know, they live off the abundance that flows from it. But when you start to actually try techniques and then do them, and you witness the feedback effect of the way that you interact with people affects the way that they react to you, And then you witness this beautiful sort of, I call it the spiral staircase, because the feedback mechanism keeps going around and around and around, but it keeps giving you this extra boost of, wow, I feel better. I feel more valued. And then people are like, wow, this person's valuable. Yep. And then you say, man, I feel even more valued and powerful. And then they're like, man, this person's powerful.
Yeah.
Witnessing that interesting effect that some people, I think, they walked right into it, you know? SI, it's interesting.
Yeah, yeah, that for some people, it can happen by accident. And then they're sort of, that because that's what it could be, because of their experiences or because of their personality, that it happens, but they don't know why, or they're not aware that it's happening. But if we can kind of piece that apart, and what are the behaviors, what are the attitudes surrounding, you know, for example, acting in a way where you're, you know, for example, emotionally sensitive to what somebody else is saying, and how do you respond to that? You know, let's not do it by accident. Let's do it on purpose, right? Let's figure out what's surrounding this. And certainly part of it, and that gets to the nature nurture debate, right? And certainly part of it, I think, is nature, that it's sort of just ingrained in our personalities, ingrained in who we are. But also part of it is definitely nurture as well. There are things that we can do, for example, to become more emotionally responsive, to become more interpersonally sensitive, to become more emotionally intelligent, and to, for example, have more control over our emotional reactions to things. And I love the spiral staircase idea of, like, you start acting in certain ways and people respond positively to it, and then it's better for everyone, right? So yeah, I love that.
I love that we went total geeking out, you know, to like, how do people work? I don't get it. And yet, trying to put like this strange, ambiguous gossamer language around, you know, things that have nothing to do with numbers and tech. And yet they're even more powerful and pervasive sometimes than those, you know. And by the way, note to any listener, if you can figure out how to measure social intelligence effectively, you have a project that could last you a career.
Absolutely. Folks have been trying to figure out that for years and years. Yeah, you know, and that's the thing. You know, my students used to say, you know, I would measure all of these touchy feely kinds of things like emotion or interpersonal sensitivity, and you know, some of them would approach it like, well, why even bother? It's that there's always going to be some bias associated with it. There's always going to be some error associated with it. We can't ever do it perfectly, Jen. Why even bother? And I say, well, what am I just going to throw up my hands up in the air and say, don't do it? Because these are really important, not even just like interesting things for some of us to geek out about, but they're the fabric of who we are as human beings. Do we want to just not try at all? No, let's do it but let's be humble about it too, and make sure that we talk about the limitations of doing any of the, for example, data analyses.
So yeah, bringing back to my physics days, it's, I put the pieces together that I could finally summarize in my own way, that you're never correct and you can never publish your numbers unless you can say how wrong they might be.
Exactly. I love that. Cool. Hey there, folks. We'll get back to the interview in two shakes of a lamb's tail. But first, are you a tech manager? Is leading your team like herding cats? Are you sick of making stuff up without trusted systems to guide you? Are your days filled with useless, time-sucking meetings? Join my Facebook group with other tech geeks who are coming together to build thriving, high-performing teams who don't need constant handholding. No HR BS, just real stories from real geeks who understand the nuances of being a techie. To join us, go to genbunk.com/Facebook. Without further ado, please enjoy the remainder of the interview. So let's shift the conversation just a little bit, because there's another, there's a question that you brought up to me in the last conversation that we had that I thought would be great to discuss for a little bit on the podcast. And so the question that you asked me was, is product a predictor, a criterion, a construct, some or all of the above, none of the above. So I'd like to explore this question. And again, we don't have to get too much into the weeds here, obviously explaining some of the terms here. But where I actually like to start, and maybe that's even where we finish, is why ask this in the first place? What is product? It's a term that's thrown around a lot in the tech world. So at a very basic level, taking out the psychometrics and the statistics mumbo jumbo, what is product? So why ask that question in the first place?
Yeah. Coming from a world of physics and science and hard science and math, and then, you know, applying it to education, which is all about, well, education, and the word product never came up once, you know, in all of that work that I ever did in teaching at a high school for 5 years. Nothing about the word product really ever came up. And then I land in this fintechy data business, you know, where we sell data, and the product manager, and I have to say the first product manager that I met, I couldn't really tell what he did. Mm-hmm. And then it took about a year and a half. And then a new one came in and started talking about, well, what does the market want? And we have to gauge and strategize what our product is or what our value offer is. And all of this language that I was like, whoa, is this a noun? Is this a verb? Is this you? Because she even related it to, well, when we hand our, you know, or give what we have to do to the next person downstream such that they can execute, you know, that's also a product relationship. So wait, now there's internal and external products, and I should think about what I do and every deliverable as a product for my next part. It just became this unbelievable, literally, it's a construct in the sense that what is math? You know, there was a point at which I went from products are always nouns. I go to the local store and I buy myself an iPod, and that's my product. Mm-hmm. And then I learned, wait a second, there's 28 products within the iPod. It's all the apps that I can add to it. It's the settings interface that allows me to change it. That's a product. Mm-hmm. And then it became like, well, the experience of actually listening to music with this convenient device in and of itself is a product offering. And then you think about the people who are making it and road mapping it, and what's the next level. It was overwhelming to me to see how the nature of whatever a product is had so completely taken over the production process or the productivity process. Mm-hmm. And hey, interestingly, right? Product is the root word of productivity. So I got lost in this sort of web of trying to figure out what is product. And I think that the question, as it emerged for me, and it's so flexible. It can be applied in so many different ways. There's a concept that I like that comes between Eastern and Western languages, and that is that the Western languages and even the Western religions are so based in nouns. We're so about talking about whatever this divinity is or thing is as a noun. It's a he, it's a universe, it's a thing. Mm-hmm. And the true nature of becoming more and more educated about what something is takes you more to the verb or the action orientation of what it is. Mm-hmm. So what is software? Software is not a noun. Software is an interactive tool. It has algorithmic designs to it. You apply rules or business rules. You have to make if-else statements. Sometimes you want to query people to make them dynamic. This suddenly software lives in this world that is between noun and verb. And I think that's where the question, you know, why product was so overwhelming to me mentally, and now to try and assess what it is, still doesn't make sense because it lives in that world between a noun and a verb. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, on so many levels. And I'm trying to figure out the best way to follow up, because there's so many different levels we can explore this. I think
is a services company.
Yeah.
And so even services themselves are verbs.
Yes.
They're never Yeah, I'll let you now just jump. I lose my ability to stay straight cognitive path when I start talking about what product is.
Well, yeah, and I can relate to that, but actually that's kind of where I was going is, sort of product company, service company, SaaS company, what are we? And I can't tell you how many conversations that I've had with folks who are engineers, engineering managers, directors, VPs, etc. Yeah, I work for this company. I don't think they know what we are. We're kind of sort of a SaaS company, but we used to, but now we're kind of moving into service, but people don't want to do that. So now it's SaaS. And so I think that this question of what is product? What do we do? What is the verb? What is the thing that we're delivering? How are we adding value to the world? How are we changing the world? You ask a lot of folks who are in tech, why are you doing what you're doing? Well, I want to change the world, right? At a very high level, that's awesome, cool. But what specifically do you do? Right? And so, and I've experienced it myself, as a, I am, all out a service-based business. I'm a coach, right? So that's the thing. That's what I do is I help tech managers, to level up in their careers and to build thriving teams, et cetera. But sometimes folks call what I do a product. And that actually, honestly, it kind of irks me a little bit because it's like, no, it's not just a thing. It's not just, I'm helping people, right? But I get it though, because this, because of the
Commoditized
flexibility.
gen bunk. Commoditized gen
Exactly.
bunk.
Exactly. But, getting to this, in that why, getting to the service piece of it and then like the SaaS piece of it, what are we doing? Is the software our business? Or is it what we're delivering in terms of helping our clients or customers, whoever you call them, and that can get to that. Who do you call them? Do you call them clients or customers? Because that can
Yeah.
have a very big difference in terms of how you relate to them. I know I realize I'm just throwing a bunch of stuff out there, but again, I think it kind of reveals how interesting this question is and also how, how like on pulse it is with what's going on at the heart of the tech industry right now.
Yeah, and I really felt the presence of this question when I was hanging out with my friends who again are going through this, VC stages of their business. And it's to solidify their product set to really be able to communicate, their elevator pitch about what their product is and how it changes business. It was like for them, it was so much more noun, because they really have to give that speech as quickly as possible. And they're so zoned in on that one thing that they're doing because they're a startup and that's the thing that they want to use to disrupt the space. But then for my company, which is a, behemoth in comparison, I think Deluxe as a whole is a $1.8 billion company. And our little region is in the client services space for marketing. And we want to offer everything. We want to be able to give everybody the email channel, the letter channel or mail channel, the digital channel, I think we're moving into online and chatbots and maybe even some groups of ours are going into VUIs or voice user interfaces, and so each one of those is a level of like where does the marketing come in, and then the client wants to do something very customized, and so now we're developing a whole new process, and now this is that product for that company. But it's not, it's a service, but it's not, it's a program. And then they, the company itself has a problem breaking down the language because there's also an ownership involved. If we call it a program, then the data analyst group and the program management group manages it. If we call it a custom model, then it's my group, and we manage it. If we call it something, some other noun, then someone else has to, start a whole new process that has its own downstream effects. So it's very interesting that all of these things are products. They all sit underneath this one person who labels, these are the things we're gonna do. And yet the people that do it are always struggling with the proper way to now handle the work, and to handle their own, I would call it scalability, because you have to think about the iterations of what the product might turn into to sort of streamline the later bits of your process, your workflow. And that's another thing that the data science job and as a whole this is what I don't see from a lot of people, that the deep analyses that they do don't slowly become more and more scalable and more automated. And that's where I think being a director, leading a team, I have to teach my team or even develop software for them that will make their own job easier so that fitting a model doesn't take 8 days. Mm-hmm. It literally can take 2.5 hours if we do it right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And as you begin to talk about some of the challenges of that are inherent in your job, let's transition to the last question, which is a question that I ask all of my podcast guests, and that is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
Yeah, this was a tough one. I have two answers because I have to think about it in two different ways. Personally, my personal problem, not a personal problem, but something I'm always working on, is to use language and to use an approach that lays within this social intelligence of it's a fundamental belief that every aspect of my workday is driven by the collective good of the people around me. I think to express your problem-solving ability, to ask critical questions, to push sort of productivity in a way that helps advance the business, there has to be this latent belief that what I am doing purposely is connected to an optimistic or an abundant future that includes all the people around me that I'm talking to. Mm-hmm. So that on a personal level, I have to do that very, you know, as much as humanly possible. It's something that I don't think anyone ever does enough. There are a few people that are always all stars in this, like the CEO usually is an all star at doing this. Mm-hmm. But that's my personal people related problem that mm-hmm. I think I always have to help and keep my finger on the pulse of whether I'm doing it correctly. Mm-hmm. Collectively, I think communication and education is the biggest people problem across the organization. We're in sort of a big stage of growth and we've acquired new businesses, and that whole problem around product and that question around that, when you take on new coworkers that have no familiarity with what your business has created as a complex group and vice versa, that we are connected to these new companies, but not knowing exactly how their stuff works, mm-hmm. there becomes a huge gap in creating a collective culture and or understanding of the product set that you're trying to offer to the world if the education doesn't take place. And then thus the communication, you know, when it doesn't take place, leads to that, you know, horrible downward spiral of resentment and, you know, not agreeing, this person I don't have a good rapport with, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I think about people related problems from my own perspective, as well as trying to assess the collective perspective of what could we do better as an organization.
Yeah, absolutely. And addressing those gaps is so key, whether it's the education gaps or the communication gaps. And really, it's about a series of conversations, you know, and sometimes they're uncomfortable conversations with people about, hey, let's admit what we don't know. Let's admit that we did this wrong. Let's admit that we can do it better. And so that's where I love the way that you phrase it in terms of thinking about like kind of the intersection between communication and education, that is sort of one of the pillars in terms of building better people relations at work, is making sure that that's in place.
Yeah, I was asked a question a long time ago around, and it was sort of like going through a self-development phase, and someone said there is these three aspects to the kind of questions you're going to probably ask yourself, you know, as you approach the later stages of life. And one of them is going to be, you know, what did you do? Which is very yang. It's very, you know, I'm on the battlefield, I'm leading a mission. It's very pro-American capitalism kind of thing. Then there's this, what did you love? Which is just about being in the same space with what it is you're experiencing, right? It's not about doing something at the time, and it's not about absorbing something from it, even though it could be in a way, but it's more just your sense of it. And then the last question is, what did you learn? Mm-hmm. What did you take from it? Mm-hmm. And I think that as a whole, the corporate experience doesn't do a lot of that third question. Mm-hmm. The people at the top do, and then they strategize the business, and then they try and move forward and adapt to change and things like that. But it's hard within a business where you're so focused on what do you do, what do you do, what do you do,
yeah,
what did you create, what did you deliver? You know, it's this action, yang orientation. Mm-hmm. And then the yin part of it, which is, well, what are you absorbing from that in the process? It's much less valued than the do part. And unfortunately, the business nowadays has to be so dynamic and so adaptable that the yin part is becoming more and more important to the collective space, to the adaptability of the business, to all these things, because the business has to be able to move with the tech that is just, you know, moving at such a pace. So the learning is that education piece. It's something that no one has time for, but man, we really got to do it.
Yeah.
You can't just lay off the people that don't understand the unified product and bring on people who will be more adaptive to it. You need to also keep that development going. Mm-hmm. And that's just not my company in particular. I notice it just within all of the space mm-hmm. around this education. The learning organization, I think, is a phrase that I heard from the 90s. And when I started looking back at the research about it, it does go all the way back to like the late 80s, early 90s. And it's just something that I don't think anybody really fully embraced to sort of make it penetrate the workspace. And I'd really like to see more companies that push that more than the do. Like, if we all learn together, we all become more adaptable together, we become more creative. It's all those wonderful things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting. I don't know.
Absolutely. It reminds me, there's a quote, and I'm totally going to botch it, but it's something like, the learners will inherit the earth, while the learned will find themselves beautifully equipped to live in a world that no longer exists, or wow, something like that. It's really, the learning is so huge. And also the three questions: what did you do? What did you love? What did you learn? Three questions that I think we can all spend some more time meditating and reflecting on. I love that. And on that note, it's just about time to wrap up our conversation, Eugene. It's been absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for geeking out with me today.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you especially for the strange side tributaries that are, we're not geeky at all. They're just straight up us trying to figure out our lives.
Absolutely. Yeah, great. It was great talking with you, Eugene, and you have a great day.
You too, Jen.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.